From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in almost every single American neighborhood, no matter the city or the state. You might have a soldier in your family. You might know someone serving overseas right now, or perhaps you know the parents of a soldier. Maybe there's a veteran in your circle of friends. We're surrounded by service members, and that means we're surrounded by people who might struggle with what happened during their service. Post-traumatic stress disorder has become a great challenge for veterans who want to work or to simply enjoy life with their families. Dr. Kathy Platone has spent years working on PTSD and related issues. As a graduate of William Smith College, she's presenting tonight at Hobart and William Smith on the subject of When Trauma Doesn't Bleed, the Psychological Toll of War. Dr. Platone is currently a clinical psychologist in private practice, but she's recently retired as a colonel with the Medical Service Corps and U.S. Army Reserve and as Army Reserve Psychology Consultant. And she is with us now. Dr. Platone, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you very much for having me. This is quite an honor.
Well, you have been a very prominent critic of how the Army in general has dealt with PTSD. Let's start there. Where has the Army gone wrong, and why have you been such a persistent critic?
Well, in recent years, diagnoses that have been rendered by licensed professionals have been overturned so that the military does not have to compensate these people with service-connected disabilities. That's one of the primary problems with veterans not getting the treatment that they need. There's the stigma of soldiers and other military personnel of all branches not wanting to obtain treatment until it interferes so much with their ability to function in the world that they have to get treatment in order to be able to put one foot in front of the other. There are the reduced numbers of mental health professionals, particularly in the active Army right now. I think there are 40 shortages, which is considerable, in the active component of the Army, which is far less than we need in the first place. The numbers of mental health professionals that are being forcibly retired because of the drawdown is a huge problem. It's multifaceted. I think a lot of our mental health professionals that come into the military are inexperienced when they first come in and don't know how to link soldiers up with the services that they need both during a deployment and when they come back from the combat theater. So, again, the problem is enormous.
And during nearly 34 years of service in the Army, you've had, and I hope I'm quoting your background correctly, four different deployments, a stateside tour of duty during the Gulf War, a command of a combat stress control detachment at Joint Task Force Guantanamo Bay, a tour of duty in Afghanistan, Iraq, one after 9/11 to help New York Police Department at Ground Zero. So you've really been everywhere dealing with these situations that would lead to mental health issues. Give me some of the things that you have seen and dealt with and the lessons you've learned about what is being done wrong with dealing with these mental health issues.
Well, I'm going to give you a prime example of how things can go wrong very, very quickly at a time when mental health services are urgent. I'm a survivor of the Fort Hood massacre, and this, again, is a shining example of how things were badly mishandled from the start. After Nidal Hassan killed 13 of our soldiers and wounded 32, including also a pregnant woman lost her life, and of course her baby was her unborn child was killed. The Army brought in, and sparing no expense, mental health professionals, the best of the best, both from the civilian sector and active duty military personnel, and contracted mental health providers throughout the Army. They were brought in from all over the United States to assist the Fort Hood community in dealing with the largest massacre on American soil on any military installation. This occurred on November 5th of 2009. We were getting ready to deploy to Afghanistan at the time. When the mental health professionals were brought in, yes, the Fort Hood community had access to these mental health services, doors wide open so that anybody who needed help could get the emergency mental health assistance, the crisis intervention that they needed. However, those of us who lost the most soldiers were on lockdown in our barracks. We were prohibited from accessing mental health services. We were given one formal critical incident stress debriefing, and the protocol for doing these critical incident stress debriefings is for only those who are on scene to be present in the debriefing. You do not have command staff in there. You don't have any administrators in there, only those people who were most effective. So they threw about 80 people or more into one room, whether they were on scene or not. And, of course, only four people spoke. So we went to Afghanistan carrying the burdens of watching our people assassinated at close range, bleed to death in front of us, without any kind of mental health services. We had each other. We bonded and supported each other, but that was it. It was a mental health disaster. In the aftermath of this, I would say that post-traumatic stress disorder is rampant in the two units that I was affiliated with that deployed, one to Iraq, one to Afghanistan, because they did not get the emergency mental health services that they needed.
We're talking to Dr. Kathy Platone, who is going to be speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Seneca Room at Hobart and William Smith, presenting on When Trauma Doesn't Bleed, The Psychological Toll of War. If you want to join the conversation, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Let's bring in Mike in Rochester. Mike, thanks for calling.
Doctor, yeah, I wanted to ask you about the Fort Hood situation. I was in the service during the Beirut bombing, and I personally think that there was an intentional neglect created so that an incident would happen. And my reaction to the Fort Hood is that that was an intentional situation established by neglect. We all know that that doctor was transferred there.
Mike, are you still there? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm still here.
Hold on, guys. Let me just jump in and say, Dr. Platone, do you want to first respond to that, his comments there?
Certainly. I think neglect is the correct word. Mike, I think you're absolutely on to something here. I think the military does an excellent job of training their mental health professionals, but allowing access to them is often very short-sighted or unavailable. We all know that in the case of Nidal Hassan, the shooter at Fort Hood, there were problems for five or six years prior to the massacre that were well known by the Department of Defense and the FBI, but they never communicated with one another. He was giving briefings during his psychiatry residency at Walter Reed Army Medical Center about Muslim extremism, and that he was a mujahideen, that his personal jihad was to do A, B, C, and D, and nobody took him seriously, as is often the case in the military. They promoted him out of a job and sent him somewhere else to make it somebody else's problem. So to answer your question, I have to agree. Neglect and irresponsibility is just egregious in some of these cases.
Let's bring in Bernard in Fairport. Bernard, thanks for calling. You're on with Dr. Kathy Platone. Go ahead.
Thank you, and this is a very interesting topic, particularly to me, because my mother is now in hospice, and my father was in World War II, and I've been trying to get her VA benefits, and I have been to the website. I have 30 years of experience in the computer business, and the VA website is atrocious in terms of complexity, and I just can't imagine someone who has got some sort of problem dealing with that system to get health care from our system. It also, one of the other things that seems to me is that as America, we are a military, if you will, violent nation, and we need to be better at dealing with the military and the whole process. It just seems to me that we've let the bureaucrats override the right way to deal with this situation. And I thank you for this topic. It's being buried, and it's embarrassing to deal with it in the United States. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and I do have some comments for you as well. I'm sorry that your mother is in hospice and that you've had such a difficult time getting access to services so richly deserved. What I recommend is that you contact the American Legion, the VFW, and your nearest elected official and raise, if you'll excuse the expression, holy hell. Your mother deserves all of the benefits that should be coming to anybody who has worn the uniform, and the fact that she has been left without them is just unconscionable.
We're talking to Dr. Kathy Platone, who is speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Seneca Room at Hobart and William Smith. She is currently a clinical psychologist in private practice, but Dr. Platone has recently retired as a colonel with the Medical Service Corps and U.S. Army Reserve, and as an Army Reserve psychology consultant, 34 years of experience in dealing with PTSD and related issues. And Dr. Platone, I want to make sure I circle back to one important point. Mike, our first caller, was saying, and I know you agreed that there was neglect in the case of Nedal Hassan, but it sounded to me like Mike was raising the idea that that was an intentionally encourage some kind of an assault or attack. I don't know that you agree with that, do you?
I don't think the attack was intentionally promoted in any way, but I think looking the other way makes it seem like that is indeed the case, when this could have been prevented long before. I don't think anybody would ever accuse the military of promoting that, heaven forbid. But I think the crime is just as great in not doing anything to disallow that from happening when somebody is making threats of they will pay if they deploy me. You've got to know that something's going to happen, that this person is going to perpetrate on innocent people when he makes threats like that. So I think looking the other way and not doing anything about that is a crime that's almost equivalent to promoting this kind of a massacre.
263-WXXI, 263-9994, Dr. Kathy Platone on us, with us until about 1:30, and then you can see her tonight at the Seneca Room at Hobart and William Smith at 7:30 as part of their speaker series there. Let's talk about action here that can help here, Dr. Platone. I'd love to hear from you. You talked about where the Army has sort of gone wrong. Give us sort of a checklist that says if the Army made several changes, we would immediately see improvement in PTSD. And if the Army won't do that, what can we do for our friends and family?
Excellent question. You're really challenging me here. I think one of the main things that we need to start with is don't retire your most seasoned professionals, mental health professionals. Number two, recruit seasoned mental health professionals from the civilian sector, people who have years of experience in dealing with PTSD. Don't bring them in at the lowest ranks. Give them the equivalent ranks that are provided to physicians coming into the military. Continue to fund the excellent training that the Army used to provide through the Combat Stress Control course, through the Force Health Protection course. Make sure that those conferences are made available to all Army and other branch of the service mental health professionals. Give them the tools. Increase the numbers of mental health professionals so that everybody has access. Embed your mental health professionals, and this is something that we did in Iraq and Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay. Embed your mental health professionals in combat arms units so that bonds are forged and the stigma disappears. So when you bring these mental health professionals in, you bring them in with the infantry, you train with the infantry, you deploy with the infantry or Signal Corps or explosive ordnance details, whatever the combat arms units, make sure that they have mental health professionals. On the home front, I've been very involved in through the writing of our two books that were written and edited by Dr. Ray Scherfield and myself, trying to train as many civilian mental health professionals, because there aren't enough military folks and VA folks to go around for the numbers of returning troops and the huge numbers of military service members coming back with terrible wounds of war. So we need to train our civilian counterparts. And in addition to training our civilian counterparts and making sure that they have wide access to our skills and to our knowledge from being in the military and from serving in the wartime theater, make sure that the VA has adequate training. So we need to take that even further, because so many of our VA professionals do not have any military experience. Again, the stigma. So we need to listen to our folks in the military and create some kind of a momentum that allows military personnel to integrate with the VA as well. So we need to come full circle with this so everybody has the same training. We're all on the same page of what our service members returning from the wartime theater are most in need of.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Please continue.
One of the best forms of treatment, and I recommend this highly because there are so few of us in the civilian sector that have served in time of war. I'm definitely a rare breed, not because of my skills, but because of my military service. But one of the best places that service members can go, and I believe you only have to have served 30 days in uniform to obtain services from the Veterans Readjustment Counseling Centers, or better known as the VET Centers, and they are staffed by veterans. And right there, you have so much more of a reduction in the stigma because they've worn the uniform. They've been quite often on the battlefield. They can talk the same language. The VET centers, in my personal experience, provide excellent services to our returning service members. They also see family members. They will see significant others, and there's no charge. So you're talking to seasoned mental health professionals who have worn the same boots.
On Twitter, Jenna writes to us, "My brother returned from Afghanistan. This is such an important topic. He's a West Point grad still trying to find a job." Dr. Platone, how often do returning veterans, no matter where or how evident their PTSD or the impacts of their services, how often do they struggle to find jobs as a result?
All too often. With so many veterans being released from the service, whether medically or otherwise, and because of the drawdown with our economy the way it is, where do veterans go for jobs? A lot of times their skills do not translate to the civilian sector. I know that through many of the VAs, they are holding job fairs nationwide right now. There are many organizations that provide veterans benefit counseling and counseling for job training, job recruitment through your local VAs, but the VET centers do a much better job of making those services available. I know that I live in the Dayton, Ohio area. Wright-Patterson Air Force Base just hosted a job fair across the board for all services with affiliation through the Dayton Veterans Administration Medical Center. So it's so important to keep your eyes open as to what is available. Another thing to look at is the Real Warriors Campaign. Do a Google search. Real Warriors Campaign does an excellent job of informing our returning military personnel of where they can go for assistance in finding jobs. There's afterdeployment.org. There are a host of resources out there. One of them has been published through, I'm going to give you my website because it's
on
there.
Oh, please do.
My website has it's the most comprehensive list of war trauma resources available anywhere in the world right now, and it was compiled by my co-author, Dr. Ray Scherfield. He is next to God in my book. My website is www.drplatone, and that's P as in Papa, L A T as in Tango, O N as in November, I, www.drplatone.com. And I will make sure that list of war trauma resources where you can find anything that you need as a returning veteran or as a family member will be available. And I will make sure that is posted on there if it isn't there already.
Dr. Platone, when you talk about the need for the Army to recruit more mental health professionals, to retain more on staff, what does the Army say about why they haven't? Is it a money issue?
It's a money issue. With the drawdown, with sequestration, with reduction in the force, a lot of mental health professionals are going away. Well, a lot of everybody are going away with the reduction in force. So that means less services. That means less trained personnel. That means less seasoned personnel.
Boy, Well, you would think that this would be prioritized, especially with the emphasis on PTSD of the last decade, but I guess not, huh?
You would think. The logic defies me. I mean, I fought for an entire year to be extended to 35 or 36 years, even volunteered to go back to Afghanistan. I probably was the longest-serving Army psychologist in Army history and volunteered to go back and do it again, and they said, time for you to go. 34 years, that's enough.
Well,
so you wonder what the mentality behind that is.
Dr. Platone is presenting tonight at 7:30 at the Seneca Room at Hobart and William Smith. Give us a sense before we let you go this afternoon, Dr. Platone, about what people will hear tonight.
I'm going to take them on a tour of the war zone. several things. I'm going to talk about the moral injury of war. I'm going to talk about the bonds that sustain us, the things that make it healthier for us to come home, the survivorship skills that soldiers learn over time, resiliency, and show a lot of pictures of what it was like over there. I want to give people a real close-up picture of what it is to serve and what a noble deed that is for anybody who is willing to wear the uniform, and how much we need to respect and honor that when people come home, because the biggest casualty or the greatest casualty of war is to come home and to be forgotten. We can't afford to do that to our returning veterans.
And Dr. Platone, last question for you, especially because you had this connection at Fort Hood during that fatal shooting in 2009. You are a person who has helped people with PTSD, but I wonder, I mean, have you recognized some of the own, some of the issues that you yourself might have to deal with? I mean, it's almost like you're on both sides of it now, and I wonder how that's impacted you.
Funny you should ask. Yes, I do have PTSD, and I do receive treatment for it at the Vet Center in Dayton, Ohio. I receive excellent services from my social worker. If I can't deal with my own stuff, and that spills over into the therapy session for the people that I'm trying to help, then I need to close my doors and go home and retire, which I'm not willing to do. It gives me a unique perspective because I understand the suffering at a whole different level, and I also know what works. So in some ways, I appreciate my battle scars, and I know what some of the, not the Band-Aids are, but what some of the most potent healing interventions are for PTSD. So it's a mixed blessing, but you know, it makes you tougher because you have to really learn how to put one foot in front of the other all over again. So that which does not kill you, you know what it does.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Platone, thanks very much. To 7:30 tonight at the Seneca Room. We'll post more information on our Twitter account. You can follow me at Evan Dawson. And one more time, Dr. Platone, let our listeners know your website.
It is www.drplatone.com. And Platone, for you military folks, is Papa Lima Alpha Tango Oscar November India. It's spelled just like platonic, but without the C.
Nice talking to you today, and we very much
Likewise.
Appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That's Dr. Kathy Platone joining us live. We're going to take the shortest break in radio. We've been talking about helping people who are sick. We're going to stay on the subject. How to be a friend to a friend who's sick is the subject next. You're listening to member-supported public radio. Oh, welcome back here on this Monday afternoon to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Sorry about that issue there. And we are talking about how to be a friend to a friend who's sick. And there's a big reason for that. In fact, Letty Cotton Pogrebin is the author of that. But you may also know her as the founder of Ms. Magazine, among many other things. Letty, I think probably a proud feminist, fair to say. Is that fair enough?
More than
All right. I want to make sure I've got there we are. And you're coming to the JCC, the Jewish Community Center of Greater Rochester, is coming. We've got Lori Harder in studio to help explain an event coming up. So before we get to Letty, Lori, go ahead and tell us what's coming up.
Thanks, Evan. We have Letty Cotton Pogrebin coming here April 2nd for a wonderful program called Lunch with Letty at noon at the JCC.
April 2nd.
April 2nd at the JCC.
And why'd you choose Letty?
Well, the book festival is celebrating its 22nd year, and the JCC in general has a fantastic cultural arts offering for the community. We have great theater, we have a fantastic film festival in the summer, and our book festival also tries to have a very wide reach to the entire community. We've all been in a situation at one point or another where we've had a sick friend or a relative where we deeply wanted to make a difference for them as a friend, and sometimes we just don't know how to. And we came across Letty's book, which just came out, and thought, how perfect. How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who's Sick gives us the opportunity to bring Letty to Rochester and her profound words of wisdom and guide for all of us in the community.
Well, and so, Letty, you're coming here. You're going to be talking about how to be a friend to a friend who's sick. You were that sick person. Tell us about your background and your story.
Yes, in 2009, I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and among the other surreal experiences associated with that was my discovery that a lot of my friends really didn't know how to react, how to treat me, what to say. People put their feet in their mouth regularly. Others were sort of threatened to the point where they almost disappeared, because it does, in fact, raise one's own sense of vulnerability when a close friend is sick. And I just realized that I needed a book to help my friends be better friends. And when I Googled Friendship and Illness, there was no such book, and I decided to write one. And I interviewed 80 people, besides conveying my own experiences, which were very vivid, with lots of different friends having very many varied reactions. And what I've come up with is a combination guide and memoir. So you can read a chapter called I Can't Believe You Said That, which is about all those flubs.
Well, and can I jump in here, Letty, and say, in that chapter in particular, and in the moments in the book when you write I Can't Believe You Said That, it was partially horrifying, because I'm sure there have been moments in my life where you find out someone who's sick and you're desperate to say the right thing, but it is so easy to say the wrong thing. And they're reading your book, and especially those sections on Can You Believe They Said This? I was a little frightened to think, oh, I wonder if I've said something similar to that. What are some of the standout, egregious, I can't believe they said that lines?
Well, somebody said to me when I told them I had breast cancer, the first thing she said was, is it fatal? This was not helpful.
I don't mean to laugh, Letty. I mean, it's...
I laughed my way through the entire interview process. I couldn't believe what people said. Well, I decided to cover all kinds of illnesses, not just cancer, and bereavement. I covered that because being sick at heart is being sick, and you have to deal with friends who are, for all intents and purposes, themselves disoriented and need help and need support. And what people said to bereaved people were astonishing. I mean, one man leaned into his friend at the wake, this widower, and leaned in and said, let me know when you're ready to be fixed up. Somebody else said to a woman who'd lost her sister, now you know what it's like to be an only child. A woman who lost her firefighter husband in 9/11 and then was diagnosed with cancer, someone said to her, you really attract bad luck. You got bad karma. And these are not people who mean ill. These are people who are just blurbing out the first thing that comes to their mind.
Or
else, I have to say, that they spout cliches, which is just as bad as some of these things that turn out to be hurtful. We do not need to hear God only gives you as much as you can handle. That's not helpful. We don't need to hear you don't deserve this. We don't need to hear it could be worse. We don't need to hear I know just how you feel. My dog died.
Again, I'm laughing because that's my instinct is to laugh. I don't mean to belittle the scenario, right?
I'm telling you honestly, I laughed my way through this entire research process because it's so human to just difficult situation, and yet, think of it. Every one of us knows someone who's sick. I'm sure there's not a person in your listening audience, because when I go around the country to speak, I never get a hand when I ask, is there someone in the audience who does not know someone who's sick? Close.
Yeah.
I never get a hand. So here we are with a universal experience, and none of us knows really how to get through it.
There was one line in there that I'm trying to remember. It was something like, cancer had spread to the lymph nodes, and a friend said, well, what does that mean? And the person with cancer didn't fully know, and the friend said, well, shouldn't you be doing more research? You know, like interrogating your friend who was just diagnosed with an advanced stage cancer. But, you know, that's why I thought this was such a beautiful book, because it's so easy to relate to walking on those eggshells. And we're going to be getting to some of your ideas for what we should do. And I loved some of what you suggested for what we all should do when we're the friend to a friend who's sick. We're going to get to that in a minute. We're also going to talk about, again, Letty said, not just cancer. She writes about dementia and Alzheimer's, and there's some really interesting stuff there. But before we get there, let's get to the phones. 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Ed in Greece, thanks for calling Connections.
Hi. Letty, I think I've met you before. I was the drama director at a camp in Western Connecticut where your twin daughters, Robin and Abby, were sometimes in plays and were wonderful to work with.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yes, Buck Camp, Bucks Rock.
That's right. That's
right. And your name again, please?
Ed Scutt.
Oh, I'll tell them that you called in. How nice, Ed.
and I'm going to come and see you a week from tomorrow. And, yes,
great.
Tell them I said hello, and maybe I can get some contact information from you.
Absolutely. They both turned out to be writers, by the way. They didn't turn out to be actresses.
Well, I'm not surprised. They did a lot of writing at Buck's Rock.
Thanks for calling, Ed. I appreciate that. And if you just heard Ed mention, if you're just joining us, Letty is coming to the JCC. And Lori Harder's in studio with us to make sure that people know the event. Lori, one more time, the details on the event with Letty.
Lunch with Letty at the JCC, April 2nd at noon. All you have to do is go on the JCC website for tickets or call 461-2000. We're looking forward to seeing all of you.
Boy, I know you are, and I know Letty is too. How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who's Sick is her book, and it's something that I think we all can relate to. Ingrid in Penfield is on the line with us now. Ingrid, thanks for writing. Thanks for calling on this Monday afternoon, Ingrid.
Right, Letty, thanks for writing
this
wonderful book.
I,
with great respect, because I very much appreciate that you're handling this topic at all, I did just want to throw out there that it's very, very complex. You've mentioned two things so far, which I'd be quite grateful to hear from a friend. I know one of them is maybe going to shock you, which is the question, is it fatal? In my family, we've got a long tradition of feeling empowered by medical knowledge, and a question that cuts right to the chase like that would actually be a comfort, because you'd know you had someone to whom you could speak the full truth at any point, because they were very brave. At least that's how I look at it. Well, and also, I just wanted to say that I feel very comforted when anyone says to me, God doesn't give you anything that you can't handle. I always think like, okay, I can do this.
It's amazing the different perspectives, because I base my statement on talking to 80 people, and the majority of them really didn't want any of the guidelines,
yeah.
Even if they were believers. They felt as if it wasn't a friend's place to interpret God's will or God's wish, or for somebody to say God must have wanted him when you're mourning the loss of a child was not comforting to these people.
No, not to me either.
Yeah, on the issue of is it fatal, I actually prescribe directness and honesty. That's the bottom line of my book, is to exchange the old etiquette for an etiquette of honesty. And that includes two chapters on how to deal with the death and dying.
Mm-hmm.
And among the many anecdotes I tell is how I had a conversation about dying with Geraldine Ferraro, who was a friend of mine of more than 40 years, in which I actually said, Jerry, how does it feel to be dying? That's different from saying to a friend, I've just been diagnosed with breast cancer, and their first reaction being, is it fatal? That's not a family rallying round. That's not a let's have an honest talk about where this might lead. That's like the first thing to hit you between the eyes is not I'm sorry, or is not I want to be there for you. It's is it fatal? I don't think that's appropriate, and most people who I interviewed thought it was really grotesque.
Well, if it's the only thing that is said, I would say that is quite odd. But, right. You know, for my family, I think there'd be more to it than just that one question. But I would sort of think that it was a cry in my family to go into action and everybody support the sick one. So I do hear you, though,
That's a very lucky thing that you, if you were in that situation and felt that and could be entirely honest, that's a blessing, really.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what we do is we refuse to allow a patient their own reality, her own truth. And mm-hmm. if someone knows that she's dying and wants to talk about it and wants the opportunity to articulate a legacy or to discuss regrets or wishes mm-hmm. or to convey a history, and we keep saying, oh, keep fighting. You can
mm-hmm.
beat this.
Yes.
That silences someone. So
yes.
I'm totally in favor of that kind of a confrontation with the truth
mm-hmm.
if someone is ready for it.
Yes.
What I think we lack, though, is the sensitivity to read how someone is going to... I mean, I'll give you another example. Here's a man who told me that when he was coming out of prostate surgery, his friend visited him and sat on, you know, the edge of his bed and said, how did it go? And the patient said, great. The doctor said they got it all. And the friend said, oh, yeah? How do they know?
I can't help but laugh at that. And
I know. So yeah. Then this man said, look, this was my best friend. A few weeks later when I was better, I engaged him on it. I said, how could you have said that? Didn't you realize that eroded my confidence in my doctors and my hopefulness and all of that? Mm-hmm. And this friend said, I'm so sorry. All I meant is, how do they know? He was like asking a question about medical science.
Yes.
He wasn't hearing, and that's what I mean about is it fatal. You
yes.
have to have a context in which a question is appropriate and realize its impact on a person in their context at the moment. So for this poor guy who's trying desperately to believe that his surgery fixed it, for a friend to say, how do they know? It was like saying, oh, yeah, don't be so sure. And for the friend, it was really, you know, how do they know? Is it a change in the cells? Is it the blood? Is it the, you know, tissues? He was asking, please educate me, which was not appropriate for the first question after surgery.
Well, I think in just part of this conversation for listeners, they understand why Lori Harder, who helped put this event together, is telling us that the topics that they bring to JCC include humor, history, friendship, music, sports, spirituality, romance, politics, health, and aging, to name a few. And Letty is not afraid to tackle any or all of that in the book. Though very interesting, Letty, that you say that most people didn't want to hear religious stuff, that God works in mysterious ways or, you know, that kind of a thing, even if they were religious. But you also stress that if you are going to drop a line like that on somebody, you better know that they are religious as well.
Right. Right. And the same thing about prayer. You know how many times I've said, you're saying how awkward you are to look back on your behavior. Me too. I know that I've said, I'll pray for you. You're in my prayers. Most people feel that is just blither. It's just a cliche. They don't believe they're really going to be in your prayers, unless you're both in a prayer group, let's say, together, or you sit next to each other in church or in synagogue. But to say you're in my prayers is kind of like saying, I'm sure you'll be fine.
Yeah, and Letty, it's interesting you say that, because a couple of years ago, there was a family who grew up five houses down from us, and their daughter was a year older than me, and she got cancer, and like a lot of people, they had a caring bridge site for her, and a lot of people, and you know, we had kind of spread her out around the country, those who grew up together, but we were all sort of following, and you know, whatever your background, everyone is pulling for her. And somebody on caring bridge, who I did not know, jumped in and said, you know, I'm a friend of hers, and I know that God's not going to let her go. I'm praying for her, and, you know, I believe in the power of prayer. And she died a month later. And I just tried to think in my head how her parents read something like that. I mean, what do you think?
Well, I know perfectly well from Christopher Hitchens, who, if you recall, was a militant atheist.
Absolutely.
And a marvelous,
marvelous essayist and writer, political commentator, who said, please don't pray for me. And yet people put up a pray for Christopher Hitchens Day on a website and made it like October 16, 2010 or something. And he said, "This I really resent this because it defies my beliefs. It disrespects me and where I'm coming from. And let me say, if I live, I do not want you people to take credit."
Well, and Christopher Hitchens showed us that there are some atheists in a foxhole.
Let me say this about prayer. A friend of mine who is a born-again Christian, and mind you, I'm a Jew. I'm pretty serious about my Judaism. She and I have discussed religion a million times, and yet when she got a stroke after being a marathon runner and the epitome of good health, and I visited her in her hospital room, and she asked me to pray with her, and I said, I'd be happy to pray with you, Janet, but not if you're going to mention Jesus. Now, this is between friends who've known each other for 25 years. I know that for her, prayer has to mention Jesus, and I can't. I accept that Jesus is a prophet, but I don't accept that Jesus is the Messiah. So I can't, in good conscience, pray with her. And she said, I don't need to mention Jesus this time. Let's just hold hands and pray together. And I was able to do that. So the sensitivity goes both ways.
Yeah.
You want to be accurate. You want to be authentic. You want to be honest. You don't want to just jolly the person along. And when it comes to talking about death and dying, as I said, the case with Geraldine Ferraro is truly instructive, because when I said to her, how does it feel to be dying, she was so proud of how she was dying. She was proud that she had organized her life, given her bequests in person, told her bishop what she wanted, who she wanted to speak and for how long, and what she wanted on her tombstone. And no one was letting her talk about what she had accomplished as a person in control of her dying as best as she possibly could be. And so I gave her the opportunity to do that, and she was grateful, because it was, again, it was her truth.
Our guest is the author of How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who's Sick. She's going to be here 8 days from now. That's two Tuesdays from now at the JCC. More information on their website. Let's get back to the phones. Randy in Rochester, thanks for calling. You're on with Letty.
Thank you. Lenny, I'm fascinated that you've written this book. I have been through both being a caregiver and also being a patient in this situation. And in particular, the incident that comes to mind is a doctor friend of mine who, when she heard that I'd had a melanoma that was stage zero and removed surgically and I was not going to require chemo, she insisted that the doctor was wrong and I was being treated poorly and that I should be, running to Dana-Farber and that I should be, doing all of these other things, totally discounting the fact that she's an oral surgeon. She doesn't really have any of this expertise at all.
Oh, my God. Well, I have to say that was something I heard over and over again from my interview subjects. They did not want anyone's advice. They had enough to do dealing with their various doctors' advice. People have clergy for spiritual support, and they have doctors for medical advice. What they need from us is friendship, a listener, a person to hug them. Very often, people who are sick are not touched. So think more in terms of, can I hug this person? Can I put my hand in theirs? Can I brush their hair? Rather than saying to them, as people told me over and over again, they heard things like, my aunt had it and she took mega doses of vitamin C and ginkgo biloba.
Right, yes. I've heard that one too. Somebody suggested to me, when my husband had heart surgery, that couldn't he just take aspirin?
And you also raise that important issue about the caring for the caregiver. You know, in a sickness situation, it's very often a triangle between the friends, the caregiver, and the patient. And what a friend is usually oriented to the patient and ignores the caregiver, who is sacrificing freedom, time, energy, lifeblood, to take care of this person. And sometimes the kindest thing you can do for the friend is to give the caregiver time off.
Well, and can I jump in? And thanks for the call, Randy. Great call. Because, Letty, we've got about 6 minutes left, and I want to run through a couple of things from the book. And the book is called How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who's Sick. It really applies to all of us. And, Letty, you had some, I thought, spot-on ideas about what we should say. Three things we should say. What are they?
Oh, gosh, I don't remember. I'm so full of them. But here are the three things that come to mind that I think open the dialogue. One is, tell me what's helpful and what's not.
Yep.
The second is, tell me when you want to be alone and when you want company. And the third is, tell me what to bring and when to leave. If those are the three things you're referring to, those are the building blocks of a genuine and honest relationship with a sick person. And those are the three things for the friend to say. The patient says the analog of those three things. I, the sick person, say, is it all right if I tell you what's helpful or what's not? Is it all right if I tell you when I want to be alone and when I want company? And is it all right if I tell you what to bring and when to leave? Because once I can tell you those things, I know that that will empower you to give me what I need. We won't be in this dance of fakery,
yep,
and cliche and this, you know, complete. It's an act. A charade where I say to you, you know, what can I bring? And you say nothing. I say to you, how are you? And you say, fine. And we both know that those are not really the answers.
Yeah, just wasting time. So if our listeners missed it or if it blew past you, the truth telling, the new illness etiquette is, number one, tell me what's helpful and what's not. Number two, tell me if you want to be alone and when you want company. Number three, tell me what to bring and when to leave. I love it. And, you know, I'm going to use it, Letty. I'm absolutely going to apply that. And I read your book. I read your book hopeful that I was already doing some of that stuff, but I fear I wasn't. So, but you also write Beyond Cancer. You write about dementia and Alzheimer's. And I certainly wouldn't call it controversial, but I would say that you have some ideas on what to do if you have Alzheimer's or if someone around you does, or if someone has dementia that is progressing. And your idea is that there is perhaps something to be gained by gathering people closest to you before all of your memories and faculties fade. And tell us about that.
Yeah, I just think that makes so much sense, because there's a moment when you kind of, you get it, you understand what's happening to you. And you still are, you have enough clarity and you're lucid enough that you know who everyone is and you have a connection to your past still. At that point, if we could all gather people together, don't think of it as a funeral. Think of it as a kind of bon voyage. And let people tell you how much you mean to them. And you tell them your memories, exchange memories. And so that when you're going into this deep, dark night, which all of us know is total, I mean, it's a nightmare, and it's happening to millions and millions of people in this country, and we might as well ritualize, create a ceremony that allows a life to have meaning before it disappears into this morass. I write about Alzheimer's and dementia because so many people are dealing with it with their parents. And elder relatives and elder friends. And yet, you know, nobody talks about how, you know, there really is nothing left of a friendship when the person sitting across from you has no idea who you are, that you were their best man, that you were their roommate in college, that you guys went to camp together. When there is no shared memory whatsoever and there's no memory, period, it's hard to say that what's left is a friendship. It's a different kind of relationship.
Yeah, you write about that kind of a party and last big celebration with friends, knowing that the memories are leaving. You said, such a ritual would, I think, constitute a proper farewell. And farewell is a hard word for people, but Letty, you tell some hard truths in this book, and I think it's beautiful. We're going to lose you in a second, so let me just say thank you for writing it, How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who's Sick, and thanks for doing it with humor and letting me laugh at myself and my own silly things that I've done, because we've all been there, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think my talk at the JCC is probably going to have more laughs than anyone could imagine, such a subject would evoke, but that's how I see it.
Well, the JCC, that's their stock and trade. They deal things so well with humor there, but thank you, and thanks for taking the time. Where can people find the book, Letty?
It's on all Barnes & Noble, Amazon, independent bookstores, wherever.
Letty, thank you, and Lori, tell people, I know you want to jump in on the book as well.
It's going to be great to see where the conversation takes us next week. Letty, I can't wait to see you. We're honored that you're going to be with us. And everybody who comes to have lunch with Letty will also have a chance to buy her book and have Letty personally sign it for them.
So if they want to go to lunch with Letty on the 2nd, what do they do, Lori?
Call 461-2000 or go on the JCC website.
Great stuff. Letty, take care. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure, Evan. Bye.
Bye, Letty.
We'll see you at the JCC here. Lori, thank you, and congrats on getting somebody who relates so well. I mean, you can just see it. So.
Thanks, Evan.
And thank you for listening on this Monday afternoon. My thanks to Roger Behind the Glass and all of you for interacting with us. I'll see you right back here on a Tuesday on member-supported public radio.